So hi, everyone. As the first half of the room now knows quite well, and hopefully the second half of the room will know quite shortly, I'm Amy Rowntree. I'm an associate professor at the University of Houston downtown, and I research and write about new media. And I dabble in lots of service projects for nonprofits who want to dabble in social media and have found many problems doing so. So a part of what you'll see today and what we'll talk about today is partly a product of both of those interests, personal and professional. So let's get to it. So hopefully this is what we'll cover today. I've done content analyses of best practices or prescribed best practices for social media. Curious to know what I was supposed to be doing in my service endeavors with these nonprofits. And then we'll talk a little bit about the actual problems with using those best practices. And then I want to look at some cases. A part of my research also involved looking at small health organizations and also small nonprofit organizations to get a feel for what they were doing and to see if there were some best practices that emerged unique and inherent to the small organization setting. So we'll look at some of those cases today. And then all of this research just got me thinking and rethinking some terms that I think will be useful to you in your endeavors, particularly as you're considering and planning which metrics you'll use to judge the effectiveness of your campaigns. And as I mentioned before, I care because this is a research interest of mine. I'm working on a book project, and as I mentioned, I'm hoping that the Q&A will give me some leads to more case studies of your organizations so I can learn a bit and gather your organizations as data points in my research. Selfish. And then also, I have this personal experience. I am the host, the advisor of the social media campaign for our master's degree program. I also am a member of several subcommittees on professional organizations, including the American Association for Teachers of Technical Writing, and also a new academic journal called Connections, all of which have really small shops, really small employees, really no employees, and a minimal amount of volunteers. And so I'm really legitimately interested in what it is that small organizations do or can do that's effective that big organizations possibly can't, or maybe it's difficult for them to do. What is it that's inherent and unique to small organizations, particularly when it comes to their success in social media? So the first thing I wanted to share with you is that small organizations obviously are increasingly using social media. There's the lure of the low cost. And this is some information from Constant Contact that did a survey of 1,500 small businesses. And essentially, they found that 73% of small businesses are using social media. The ones who aren't, the 27% who aren't, 81% say that they're going to use it very, very shortly. And they're finding some success, more success using social media than they are more traditional communication outlets like direct mail. I mean, if you look, moderately or very effective is blue. And if you look at the bars, websites, blogs, email marketing even, online advertising is kicking direct mail's butt, essentially, right? And this survey also assessed which social media small organizations use, right? So most all use Facebook, and this actually bore out in my research of small nonprofit organizations as well, that most of them use Facebook and they find it effective. Most of the organizations or small businesses that use Twitter, unfortunately, find it ineffective. And some of the cases that I'll share with you will demonstrate why they're just not using it properly. They're not using it to its fullest advantage. Most of whom use video sharing find it highly effective. There are not many people using video sharing. So nonetheless, small organizations are relying on social media to augment their traditional organizational communication strategies. And so I wanted to know what they're doing. How is it that they're structuring the content that they put in these social media campaigns? And so I did a content analysis of just about 150 best practices blogs, Social Media Today, best practices textbooks and how-to books. And I came up with six general rules that were common themes among all of these best practices, or the prescribed best practices. And the first of which being, you got to know your mission and purpose. So this means you're aligning your efforts with your organizational mission, and you are identifying the specific audiences beforehand. You're identifying the specific audiences that you're trying to reach, and you design a communication, a social media campaign and a content around that purpose. And then, of course, you have to develop strategies and policies to implement in order to actualize this purpose. And so typically, drawn again from another content analysis of several social media policies, typically those social media policies contain what individuals and units in an organization are permitted to do with social media, what permissions they're afforded, practices are allowed, what content they're allowed to generate, editorial guidelines around those, around that content, and then also timelines. Then, most best practices recommend that you initiate a training program. So, you know, you've got to have an ongoing training program so that everyone understands the benefits, the virtues of social media, that everyone's best equipped, knowledgeable in these best practices. And typically these best practices recommend that you invite your volunteers, invite your audience to participate in what you're doing. So you're using the social media to attract audiences to campaigns and events and fundraisers. That's pretty uniform best practice among all of these sources. Second to last, you've got to know your metrics, and you've got to be sure that you're setting concrete outcomes. And these outcomes typically entail likes and followers and friends and corresponding emails. There's a lot of literature out there on sentiment. So essentially doing another content analysis of all of your likes and all of your followers and all of your comments to see whether or not it's a positive sentiment or a positive sentiment towards your organization or a negative sentiment towards your organization. And all of these are supposed to support your established overall marketing and communication strategies. And so what I found, having conducted a content analysis of about 150 small organizations, is many small organizations follow these rules as best they can. So you'll see, for example, a lot of the content that they generate includes news and events, 43% of which. Other organizations, they partner with other organizations in campaigns and promotional events. They also publish a lot of studies and polls. So this is, again, the content generated in these organizations' Facebook pages for about a month. I looked at each organization for about a month, their content. So they're doing, it appears that they're following the best practices. Unfortunately, there are mixed results. of these 150 organizations, average followers are 347 of these Facebook pages, which I'm not sure, but just based on those best practices, is moderate to lukewarm, if at all. The average total comments that they got in that month is 11. So minimal interaction. And their average likes are about 27. So this got me thinking about the typical problems that I face attempting to implement a social media campaign for the small organizations with which I, for whom I serve. We were short-staffed. We didn't have any funding. What funding? We were volunteers. We didn't have time for social media. I mean, for me, it wasn't my full-time gig. I'm a professor. So I didn't have time to devote to developing a strategy. Most of the people with whom I coordinated didn't even use social media. So the learning curve on that training would be steep, very steep in some cases. Some people were diametrically opposed to using social media, personally, morally opposed to using social media. And so I started joining chats, Twitter chats, for associations and also for community health centers, all of whom have similar constraints. And they had the same experience. There were people who wanted to use social media effectively, but they had the same problems I faced, that it's too small, and also they've had more luck using their personal Facebook pages and their personal Twitter feeds, recruiting volunteers than they did the actual organizations. So, two things, or problems. I sort of wanted to characterize the problems with a few metaphors. I felt a lot like Don Quixote. I felt like I was attempting to do things that there's no way that these organizations could do. Chasing and trying to conquer windmills. And I also felt a little bit like Fox and Grapes because I did all this research and I knew that I couldn't actually implement it, these best practices. So I said, you know what? I don't need them anyway. And I felt a little inferior. I think that particularly in the organizations and the committees in which I serve, and I don't know if this is true of you, we felt a little inferior. We felt like we were trying to do something that was impossible based on the best practices that we saw and based on the social media campaigns of big organizations. We couldn't possibly do what they were doing. So I went looking. I went looking to see what small organizations do. And so I did a content analysis of several organizations. Right now, I'm not quite complete, but I've finished 50. And of these, I pulled aside five or six examples and actually did some interviewing to figure out, and turned some of these into case studies to figure out what exactly they were doing that seemed unique. And so one of the things that, one of the themes that surfaced was the notion of decentralized administration. And so the best example of this that I could, that I wanted to present today is riot cleanup. So many of you know that around August of last year, there were some riots in London revolving around the shooting of Mark Duggan. How many of you are familiar with this? Good. Several. Okay. So people were showing up spontaneously. They'd hear about some shop that was ravaged in the riots, and they would spontaneously show up to with brooms and cleaning materials to help this local business person. Okay, so then Dan Thompson and Sophie Collard saw this happening on Twitter, and they decided, why don't we just throw a hashtag on it? Let's call it Riot Cleanup. And whenever we see someone saying that they're going to stop by some local businesses to help them, to help clean up, we're just going to retweet it, and we're going to put the hashtag on it, Riot Cleanup. What emerged was the coordination of hundreds of volunteers at hundreds of locations in London, cleaning up in a matter of minutes what might have taken that shop owner months to do. This hash attracted, at peak, 70,000 volunteers or followers on Twitter, 50,000 of which, approximately 50,000 of which, they did in 10 hours. It trended on Twitter, obviously. But the hashtag came after the effort, right? The hashtag was sort of an ends to the mean, right? The organization came after the fact. It helped structure the outpouring and facilitate the outpouring. It helped communities from around the globe donate to the efforts. But unlike best practices that say that a purpose comes first, this organization's purpose came after. It was only afterwards that, through sort of meditation and reflection, we get the billboards and the posters and the T-shirts, making sense of this effort, putting purpose to this effort. So that was one small organization of two people that completely contradicted best practices to great results, including coverage, international coverage, and offspring, similar efforts in Manchester and Lewisham. Another really good example of something unique that small organizations do really well is bottom-up messaging. So this is an organization called Girl Trek, and they each year host a Komen-like walk to help African-American women get a hold of their health, take a proactive role in their health. A part of also what has emerged as a purpose of this organization run by two people is reclaiming African-American beauty. Right, so there, bell hooks and others have written about the stigmas around African American health and African American beauty, and so a secondary and emerging purpose from this organization is not just reclaiming health, but reclaiming pride in African American beauty. So, how did they do this? How did this purpose emerge? Well, they did it by hosting a Facebook page, and only a Facebook page, that last year had about 6,000 followers, and this year has 63,000. So each month in the past year, they've added 5,000 followers, most of whom don't even actually participate in their girl track in the walk. This page, hosted by two people, creates approximately 4-5 unique posts per month. Most of their content is generated by women who are proud, who set their own health goals and choose to share their experience and use this as a podium to share their experience with the other women who share this purpose, share this goal. So they use Facebook as a platform to certainly support their missions and their goals, but the goals that sustain the content of this page have very little to do with self-directed or Vanessa and Morgan's direction, and more to do with the people who've taken an interest in this organization and what it stands for, and post their own related content thereby sort of changing the direction of this organization's purpose, spreading the organization's purpose. Another really good example of what small organizations can do really well is they can make meaningful what I'm going to call trivial content. So not just trivial in that it's kind of purposeless, seems a little purposeless, but in terms of biology, trivial is in really, really unique, not generic. So this is the Barnum Museum in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And they have a Twitter page that they use essentially to funnel content from their Facebook page and from their YouTube channel. The Barnum Museum has been closed since August 2010, when a hurricane ravaged the place. But in that time, they've grown about a third. They've gained a third, about 400, 500 unique followers in that time. Now, how did they do that? Their direct organizational purpose, their direct communication goal, is to bring traffic into the museum, right? But that's not even a possibility at this point. So what they do instead is they show snippets of their exhibits. They walk followers through new exhibits. When they add artifacts to their collection, they'll actually film the unpacking of it and the setting up of it. And then they also just share sort of anecdotes, clips from their primary data. They've got P.T. Barnum. They've got archives, letters, original postings, newspaper clippings from P.T. Barnum. And so they just post these as bits of factoids and bits of trivia on their Facebook page. And what seemed unusual and unique to them gathered a following. In fact, it sustained their membership, sustained their donors through this period when they actually can't be physically there at the museum. They don't have neither healthy black women and girls or the Barnum Museum or no one I've mentioned so far has a social media policy. None of them. Generally speaking, they recruit the people who already use social media. They don't have guidelines. They may recruit an intern. They may give that intern guidance. But they really use their own unique circumstances to derive the content. And also, they don't use it as a marketing tool necessarily. There's nothing marketable, generally speaking, about some of the trivia that they're sharing about P.T. Barnum. Not directly, in ways that best practices would suggest or recommend. Another really good example of what small organizations can do with social media is Fields to Families. So they're an organization in South Carolina, Mount Pleasant, I think it is. And what they are really good at doing is using social media to share moments over messages, which seems to contradict the final best practice of using social media to advance a preset and predetermined organizational communication strategy. So they, too, have a Twitter page that feeds where they feed their Flickr stream and their Facebook page. But I love their content. So this organization, what they do, what Fields to Family does, is they promote and recruit volunteers for local gardens, for creating and sustaining local gardens in food deserts and other places where fresh foods are unavailable. And what they use as their content for these pages are great pictures of food. Just really great pictures of the food that they gather. And smiling faces of the people who've come to glean and to harvest the crops. And that's pretty much all they post, or the majority of what they post. Especially during the gleaning season, and also when they often they'll cooperate with other organizations like Meals on Wheels, and they'll host huge dinners for less fortunate, and they'll have these great pictures of people eating and having fun over dinner. So it's less about some specific message and more about demonstrating at that moment what the organization is doing, and that they're doing something with real people around real tables of great food. Again, this organization does not have a social media marketing strategy. None. This organization, I think, has 20 employees or 20 people on the staff, two of whom are responsible for posting 100% of the content. And all of these organizations, when I interviewed them, said that their measure, how they measure the success of their, all of them said that they used Hootsuite and these other, they mentioned them as asides. That's how they sort of are able to post without regularly, without necessarily posting every day. So, sure, they're using traditional software for orchestrating these campaigns. But when I asked them, well, how are you measuring the success of these campaigns, all of them said interaction, which I'm going to define a little better later. But you can see how creating and sharing these moments of activity for the organization makes a difference in giving their followers, giving their Twitter followers and their Facebook friends something to interact with. And I think this is my last example. So another really good example of what small organizations can do very well is the Animal General Hospital. And they are in a small, not small, mid-size, community in Florida. No social media strategy, no plan. Two people post to this page, they have a Twitter page, and they have a YouTube page, and they have a Facebook page. They give their, Animal General Hospital, they give their techs. I think they said that they have five of them. They give them flip cameras, and they film interesting things that go on in their day. They have a Wi-Fi. The office is Wi-Fi connected, so they can instantly upload clips to their YouTube, to the YouTube account. And what they typically upload are unusual cases. In this instance, a tech found something strange in a cat's mouth, and they didn't know what it was, so they crowdsourced it. They also share video clips of common procedures that their clients undergo but might not have known what their pets actually experience. And they find that this is their most popular kind of content. So what I think is unique about Animal General Hospital is what I call transitional communication. A lot of what they share on their Facebook page and their YouTube channel is not exactly internal communication or external communication. It's not necessarily, it's typically what one tech might ask of another or one tech might demonstrate to another, but they just sort of write it large and they publish it. So it's transitional in that it's internal, but they're making it external. They're showing, as Rick mentioned, they're using social media to show what their clientele, what their followers might not see otherwise. And they're sharing things they can't share anywhere else, so it can't necessarily support a cohesive organizational communication strategy. Okay, so let me sum up what we just seen. So best practices tell us that we're supposed to know our mission and our purpose. But missions and purposes, according to these case studies that I've found, can emerge ipso facto after the fact. And you can be just as successful in such a campaign. Best practices say you need a strategy, you need a plan, you got to stick to the plan. But a lot of people operate really successfully without them. They say you're supposed to train your staff. Most of these people just take people who are already personally experienced in it, have a vested interest in it, and it works just as fine. You know, they tell you, invite them to your events. Put up your flyers and your posters and your campaigns. But some of the best practices in small organizations occur when you're broadcasting their activity, when you're broadcasting your followers' activities and you're supporting them. They tell you use established metrics. But a lot of these people are just saying, we just want to interact a little more. They're lower ball, they're lower stakes metrics, they're lower stakes goals. And they set them, they create them there as they go. And also, best practices say that you should use social, integrate it, and use it in a full suite of organizational communication strategies. Sometimes the best of what they do, these small organizations, best of what they do, does not directly support any strategic plan or goal. Okay. Which I liked. It was revelatory to me to see that other people were as confused or seemingly confused as I was, but doing things that were enviable with social media. I was very emboldened. And so it got me thinking. It got me thinking first about reconsidering what it means to be an organization and what it means to support organizational goals with communication practices. So no matter what model you're considering, you know, there are several. These are just three. When you're teaching organizational communication, you know, you first have to understand what kind of organization you're in. There are distributed organizations, centralized organizations, coordinated organizations, the organizations that work like systems, the organizations that work from a cultural model. There are critical approaches to thinking about organizations. But every one of them is more closed than opened, I guess, to put it in Clay Shirky's terms. And not only that, but they're unnecessarily so. So when you're thinking about moving your organization from a closed model to a more open model, where you are relying less on best practices and more on intuition, or where you are relying less on infrastructures and more on using cooperative models of communication and of accomplishing tasks, coordination. I thought it was I thought it would be good to consider ants. And ants don't, in any mound, there is no, it's certainly a very effective system, wouldn't you say? Have you? Most ant mounds that I know are very efficient at rebuilding themselves even when I try to destroy them. And most mounds have a queen, maybe two queens, but they don't have centralized management. How is it that ants accomplish, worker ants accomplish so much without someone telling them what to do? Biological studies tell us that people like Deborah Cooper tell us that how they do this is they use patterns. They use pheromonic patterns, and they use their antennae, use patterns to tell what tasks need doing and how many ants need doing them. And they also, mounds operate on really simple, intuitive, logical, this simple, flexible decision rules in these patterns. And it made me think, I'd like, it, from a personal perspective, when I go back and I start helping the organizations for whom I serve, when I start helping them think through how to organize this more open approach to structuring their social media campaigns, I'm going to think like an ant mound. I'm going to tell them to think like an ant mound. And instead of certainly boil down what they do into really simple algorithms, really simple rules, flexible rules that can accommodate all of the small organization best practices that I just described. And then also thinking about these organizations also got me thinking about what it means when people say that they are using social media in authentic ways. I mean, what does that mean? I'd like to ask you, when you hear someone say, social media is so powerful because it's, you can be authentic. What do they mean? Transparency how? Yeah. Although that might not be transparent, right? Like I've heard lots of small business and large business advice saying don't be authentic, because when you're authentic, you show as many of your flaws as you do your virtues, right? For that very reason. I mean, it's so. I guess yeah, transparent certainly, and also showing parts of yourself that you don't normally show, maybe. Yeah. So these cases got me thinking about what it means to be have an authentic presence online. And so I went back. I'm a philosopher that I am, double major English philosophy. Sorry. I knew it would come in handy someday. I knew I knew not to be a philosopher, otherwise I'd probably be living under a bridge somewhere or in politics. I knew it'd come in handy. Here it goes. So I'm thinking more like how philosophers define authenticity, right? So I'm thinking Sartre, I'm thinking Heidegger, Kierkegaard. So there are commonalities how they think of it, right? They think of authenticity in terms of being rather than thinking about being, and they think of it in terms of good faith versus bad faith actions, right? So what is a good faith action? A good faith action is something that you do for its inherent, or you do on your own. It's your own act. And the action itself affirms your being. So, in Sartre's words, existence precedes essence. And a lot of these smaller organizations were introspective. A lot of the content they generated was introspective. They didn't so much, their communication wasn't to recruit or to entice or to sell, but rather to show their actions. It was very action-oriented. And in these ways, I think that smaller organizations can achieve a degree of authenticity that larger organizations can't. And then also, it got me rethinking engagement. And so I like using the engagement quotient to demonstrate what I mean. So are you guys familiar with the engagement quotient? This is a metric that is meant to challenge ROI, return on investment, right? So the buzz is to transform thinking about return on investment to return on engagement, because that's what you can actually accomplish with social media. You can get people more engaged. But if you look at the engagement quotient, it's all about what your followers provide you, right? They can give you likes plus 7 times your comments, plus 7 times your fan posts, plus 2 clicks. All that summed up and divided by your fans, and there has to be a minimum of at least 500 fans. But what I saw from these small organizations is engagement is more effective, and by effective I mean not just emotional. There's a huge field of what's called critical effective studies, and it talks about how intimacy is bodily, it's emotional, right? So usually when an organization thinks about gauging engagement, it's all about what their followers do, how much flesh their followers put in the game with likes and comments and fan posts. But when I see when I think about each of these case studies, the small organizational case studies, what I see is they put more flesh in the game. They actually put their daily goings on. They use social media to embody that organization and share levels of intimacy with their followers, with their volunteers, with their members, in ways that I don't see larger organizations doing. And so if a lesson can be learned from these small organizations, it's that engagement should be effective. It should be not just about what they provide you, but what flesh, what presence you, and what intimate presence you share with your followers and with your Facebook friends. And then the last thing is just in sum. When I asked each of these organizations when I interviewed them, I asked them, like, what would you say if you had one thing that you could, one bit of advice that you could share with other small organizations about being successful, given the limitations of your size, what would you say? So some of these are what they said, and some of it's just sort of derived from what I learned from these cases. And the first is Lindsay at the Barnum Museum said, say it when you need to. Don't be afraid to say what you need to say when you need to say it. And then Rich at the Animal General Hospital said, you know, give real content. Don't just fill your pages with garbage. Give them stuff that actually happens in your daily goings on. And then the Fields to Family, Tyler said, be concise and but also be consistent. You know, post regularly, but don't overflood them with useless content. And then I would recommend, I'd add on top of that, cherry pick your best practices. Don't feel guilty. If you don't do it that way, fine. Use the ones that you can use in good faith. Scrap the rest and invent your own best practices. Always act in good faith. Use organic metrics. Find them when you need them. And build them when you need them. Track interactive patterns. Don't just look at likes and blindly apply the emotion quote, the engagement quotient. You know, look for the patterns of engagement that are most successful, and find ways to just apply upon that simple heuristics, simple small decision rules in how you conduct your campaigns that make all the difference. And that's it. That's all I have. Questions, please. I'm so curious. So you got to tell me your name. You got to tell me your organization, because I, like I said, this is ongoing research. I'd love to hear about your organizations and your organization's needs.
Elliot McFadden with Foundation Communities.
Foundation Communities. So what do you do?
I am the communications coordinator.
No, what does...
Oh, Foundation Communities is the...
What do they do?
Yes, we're an affordable housing nonprofit. We're also an asset building nonprofit, so we help people get out of debt, file their taxes, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you had mentioned at the very beginning that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with small organizations with Twitter. And,
yes.
And then you alluded to part of the reason is that they're not using it correctly.
Right.
Could you go into a little more detail about that?
So there, what I found in these six cases, and I'm pretty sure that this is the... And what I also found from personal experience, how the organizations with whom I work use Twitter, is they use it to just funnel... announcements that they've made, posts or updates to their other pages. And if you look at how people use Twitter, that's not how they use it. They really don't care about that, right? And it also, it varies in terms of, typically you're using Twitter for communication, right? You're using it to actually have a conversation with someone who's in another place. And you might also use it, another really common way to use it is you share links to resources, right? But mostly the best practices for using Twitter involve using it for conversation. So you'll get hashtags that sustain because they have regular appointments where people come and answer questions and ask questions about a comment. You'll get like a community of practice who comes and asks questions about their practice around a hashtag, regularly scheduled. Those are the most successful uses. And the way that they're using it is just sort of like it's the way traditional communication, traditional communicators use their traditional outlets like flyers and billboards. It's like an announcement, a broadcasting. I've done something somewhere else, right? So they're not generating really unique content that helps facilitate conversations the way that Twitter is best applied. They're using it to sort of funnel in announcements about things they are doing elsewhere. So typically they're not generating unique content, and I'd say that's probably the biggest problem.
Hi. Hi, my name is Jack Aponte. I work with Palante Technology, and we do work with lots of community organizations and nonprofits around the country that are very, very small. So one thing that you mentioned was that one of the groups actually has like users, their members, the Facebook groups, that the Healthy Girls and Women one.
That's right.
Submit content.
That's right.
Something that we always get worried about with the organizations is that, A, they won't have time to like get all that content and go through it and yes. figure out what to post, or B, they might hurt people's feelings if they can't post certain things that like just won't jive with whatever.
Yes.
How do you find organizations deal with those things?
I know how large organizations do it. They have editors, right? They have people who vet the comments and people who police them. But Tanya and Vanessa don't. And I guess it's just unique. I don't know how they do it. They are a miracle to me. I also like the page. I mean, I followed them from afar until I just love the content. So I liked it. And I get the regular posts. I've never seen an argument break out in Healthy Black Women and Girls. I actually don't know how they do it. I'll ask them and I'll follow up with you. I know that larger organizations actually have someone censoring and vetting and editing the posts as they come. But it might be the case that, I mean, I don't know your, do you think that you'll have factions of dissatisfied members? I mean, I guess because it's such a positive sort of a purpose that they have of, That's true. Although, yeah, I don't know many. I don't know many anonymous Facebook posts. That's right. Perhaps it's the medium that's also a means by which they are able to control the content. I don't know who.
Oh, does it work? Yes, it does. Great. Hi, my name is Andy Forrest. I'm with an organization called Maker Kids in Toronto, and we have a hackerspace for kids that we inspire them to actualize their own ideas and inventions. And so I just thought, we're experimenting with really engaging with kids in social media. I'm just wondering if you have any experience with that, if any advice for how to engage differently with kids rather than adults in this space.
You know, I don't. I actually, the organizations that I chose to research, primarily their membership is adult. Well, I stand back up. I have some questions for you.
Sure.
So what are you using? Are you using Twitter?
We're using Facebook right now, and even though kids aren't allowed on Facebook, they all are anyway, and we're finding we're posting a lot of pictures of their projects and things that we do at events, and they tend to comment less, but
like a lot,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And their comments are very short when they have them. They seem to communicate differently with.
So, are you, once they follow you, are you following them? Are you listening to them as much as they like you?
That's a good question. Listening to them, we're not getting a lot of content really generated by them, though. It's mostly just commenting on content that we
but
have.
But once they like you, you have access to their pages, yes?
I don't think we do. As a page. Yeah, I don't think we do
as a page.
That's a good question. I haven't really tried to look at their content through their own personal pages.
Yeah, I mean, some of it might be blocked, but some of it might not. I mean, one thing could be to listen. Do you use polls?
No, we haven't tried that yet with them.
I'm fascinated. Like I said, the organizations, the health organizations mostly that I research, you know, they're not, the target is adults.
Right.
So
yeah,
I would be curious to know, maybe, can I switch cards with you?
Sure, yeah.
I would love to know more, and I would say, listen as much as they like you.
Yeah, and that's a good idea with polls. Maybe do things to encourage them to give us feedback. And
yes.
I'm just thinking right away, like just have a bunch of things and see what interests them most in terms of projects or methods of creating projects.
You know, another thing that Healthy Black Women and Girls does is they feature They profile. It's kind of every week, every other week. They've gotten a bit slow about it lately. But every week or every other, they'll feature one of their followers. And they do it by just contacting that follower and saying, you know, we love what you've posted or we like what you've shared. Can we please profile you? And they'll profile whatever health goal that person accomplished in that week. So maybe
That's a great idea.
You solicit it.
Sure. Yeah, because then we can talk to one particular kid who's done a bunch of different things and ask them why did they
choose
this.
Although I have to say, just from as a researcher, just from sort of an IRB human subjects perspective, you want to get the blessing, someone's blessing before you do that.
Sure, of course. A parent. We have lots of engagement from parents on the social media already.
Maybe that's much easier. Maybe you use as a contact the parent first.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Get their permission.
Please switch cards with me.
Sure, I will.
Before this is said and done.
Sounds good.
Hi, my name is Michelle Hernandez. I'm here in Austin for the newly formed Urban Poultry Association. We do a kind of like a backyard garden tour, except we do it for poultry, a coop tour every year, and it's actually grown very successful and do things with chickens. And it's big, it's hot. But that being said, thank you for this presentation. You mentioned you're always looking to like follow more, get more data for your project. How would we go about that best? Just switch cards with you after?
Yes. And here's how I'd love you to do it, to be honest. So this hash that we've created for the purposes of this discussion, I'd like to continue it. I want to make this the place where we, as small organizations, come out of the closet, if you will, about our limitations and our needs and our best practices. So we can keep the conversation going on SM for orgs, and you can always contact me on Twitter, and also I can give you, I've got plenty of cards to exchange. The more, the merrier. I wish that more people had stayed, because I know they're darting off to the next and fighting the rain. But I really am interested in, the more data points I have, the better. So please swap cards with me, keep in contact with me. Someone is at the mic. You're next, though. You're next.
This is a question for you as much as for anyone else. I'd like their opinion. My name is John Four. I work with a venture fund out of Dubai. And I invest in emerging markets, startups in the tech space. And one challenge that we've had is many of the established companies don't practically have people that will engage or are familiar with social media.
Mm-hmm.
So that means they end up consulting or hiring consultants or outside firms. What are some of the best practices or worst practices you've seen in engaging outside contractors to do social? Because that's
when they don't already, right?
Well, no, I mean, the contractors, there's about 1,000 firms that offer to do social, and some are just very not good, and some are great. But it's difficult for companies that don't have familiarity with social to identify what are the KPIs or you know, very practical things other than just get us a lot of fans. So I was just wondering if you've had some insight in that or what your thoughts have been in best practices for engaging social media consulting companies.
You know, I haven't, but I tell you what. The Hash Association chat happens on Tuesdays, and the Hash CHC chat happens on, I think, Wednesdays. And I know that when I join these conversations, there's a lot of swapping going on regarding, they're great. Please use them. Or can I please have their contact, this consulting firm's. So I say you crowdsource that as well.
Sure.
You know, join, the community of practice that's most akin to, your business,
right.
And ask them,
okay,
have you heard about this particular consulting firm? Do you have recommendations?
Sure.
That's what I would recommend.
Okay. Great, thanks.
Others here? Did you have a suggestion for him?
No, I
Did you have a suggestion for him?
Are you internally incubating companies?
Come on. Wait, you're next. I thought you said you're next.
I'm in a VC that internally incubates about 8 companies. I manage social media for basically all of them. And I would do it internally, and I think it would be cheaper.
Sure.
Really?
Yes.
Now, why do you say that?
Because I know that I'm really cheap to have.
Want to move to Dubai?
I will.
What's the likelihood of that happening, by the way?
What?
Incubating, internal.
No, that's exactly what we're doing right now.
So what's wrong with that? Why not?
It's, that's what I anticipate. But I find that there's a number of smaller and mid-sized companies that want to do it independently. And
they're just familiar with
hiring. But you don't have to, right?
Completely
so
agree.
If you're looking,
completely
so one
agree.
Thing you can, one take home from my presentation, one take home from my presentation could be, if you're thinking there's some best way to do it, fine. But know that there really isn't, right? Know that that what you do internally might be just as effective as someone seeking it elsewhere.
Good point. Thanks.
Haven't. How do you think that might affect it? I mean, I can think of several ways it might, but...
There, control of the conversation.
It raises the stakes,
because,
right?
Because, you know, we have messaging, and there's some fear of letting go of that messaging. What are they going to say, and might it hurt themselves? Might they cut off their nose in spite of their face, you know, while they rant about it, and they certainly are...
I've actually had experience, and it's running my units, running my master's programs, social media content, and administration they're crazy, they're very heavy-handed about who gets to open up social media accounts, what it looks like, what icons we can and can't use, how the page is constructed, and what content we can and can't do. They've sort of ceded it over to my authority because I'm a tenured professor. I understand the reluctance, and I think it's just by sheer luck that I was afforded permission to do what. But I totally understand that the stakes are extraordinarily higher when you've got people with vested interests, like state funds and political agendas. Totally understand that.
I mean, do you think you can create a real community when you have to?
I can tell you right now.
So
to be
much?
Honest with you, no. I mean, we've had really what administration's heavy-handedness has done is we have just stuck to best practices, and we've had poor results as a. So that's a case I lose. I chalk that one up to that's a loss. I can always push. And, you know, one thing that's happening, too, I know right now we're doing sort of a rebranding where we're trying to figure out our identity as a university and what that will mean for recruitment and retention. And I feel like then is the time, if there's ever a transitional moment like that at an organization where the political stakes are higher, that's the moment to do it. And that's the moment to start using some of the lessons here, like bringing in notions of authenticity and bringing in notions of actual engagement and what that looks like when you're trying to rebrand, or you're trying to, even at a very politically charged organization, when I'd say that's probably the best time to do it. I don't know that that's the platform, but I'd say if you want to make a change in how, shake up a little bit of the reservations about what to post and who gets permission to post, the best time to do that is when the organization is rebranding or changing how it does things. Thanks. There's 1 minute. Well, please come take my cards. Please exchange cards with me. It has been a privilege. Thanks. And please share your stories with me.
Thanks.